the Sports Coaching Podcast with Sam Holmshaw.
I'm Ben Barron, and you're listening to the Sports Coaching Podcast with Sam Holmshaw.
Okay, welcome to the latest episode of the Sports Coaching Podcast with me, Sam Holmshaw. As always, we hope everyone is well in these strange and troubling times, but very delighted to be on a Friday evening, joined by all the way over in, I believe, is it in Cardiff or are you in Gloucester, Ben?
Yeah, in Cardiff, Wales.
Cardiff, Wales. Benjamin Bell, Ben, how are you?
I'm very good, thanks, yeah.
No, we've just spent about 5 minutes asking how to pronounce your name, so I'm just for call you Benjamin instead of Bell. But no, good to hear you. Okay, I'm not too bad myself. How's the whole lockdown period and phase been for you? How's it impacted your coaching? You managed to get through it okay?
Yeah, just about. Yeah, it was tricky. It was tricky at first because obviously, as a coach, we spend all summer waiting for the season to start, and as soon as it was about to start, we were told that we weren't allowed to start. So it made it really frustrating from that point of view. But now it's actually been really enjoyable. Luckily, the group I'm working with are really, really good. So they didn't get too frustrated throughout the process, even though it was like, all right, guys, I know we're training and I know we don't have any games planned, but stay with us. You know, and it was nice. We had our last session before the new fire break lockdown in Wales on Thursday, which was a really chilled out session with all the boys live, which was basically just let's enjoy being around people again before we go back into a new lockdown when we'll all be at home for a few weeks.
Yeah, good. Sounds like it was really, really positive for you. So that's really good to hear. So Ben, you know, as I always do at the start of the podcast, you want to just spend a good 5 minutes just telling us a bit about your coaching background, your journey, and what's led you to where you are today, just for all the listeners?
Yeah, sure. So I was never the best sports person. I was that guy who played for the really good teams, but wasn't the best player in that team. So I've got a nice trophy cabinet, but I didn't do a lot in those teams, which I suppose when you look back, like actually, that's probably the best situation to be in. But no, so that's what I think probably what got me more into the coaching staff, because I realized actually I wasn't going to be a professional sportsman. And then I started coaching while I was in sixth form, so I would have been 16 at the time, just doing like running after school clubs and getting involved there, which was really, really cool for me, because at the time I couldn't coach. I had no idea how to coach. Like, I couldn't improve performance of anyone. But the only thing I did know, I knew how to play football. So I was like, right, guys, we're just going to play football in every football session we do. And that's it. So the only thing I had to go on was, can I build relationships with the people I'm coaching? Because I know I can't do anything else. So it was just about being a sort of sixth former who the kids got to know and they could sort of socialize within the sessions and stuff like that and sort of get to know me, which was really, really cool for me. And it's nice now that I think some of them are now going off to university or trying to go off to university anyway with the lockdown. So it's quite nice to sort of keep in touch and see where they've gone off to. And I've done a BSc in sports coaching with the University of Gloucestershire, which was really good. And I'm currently studying for an MSc in sports leadership, where my research topic is around coaching behaviours and looking at how coaches behave in sort of football settings and things like that. So I'm currently in the process of conducting that research. Aside from that, I work in a secondary school doing things like behavioural support for a group of like very challenging students in the school, which is interesting because it means you just have to use all sort of understanding of trying to build relationships with people in a different setting, but it's just a more intense version because you're seeing these kids every day and you're with them all day. So it's been good for me because it's been really different. I've had to, you know, I think it makes you appreciate some of the guys you train with who are really, really good.
Definitely.
Yeah. Actually, you see the other end of the spectrum because the kids I coach in the football team are from stable backgrounds, stable households, they're very well behaved, they go to good schools, from nice areas, and they're lovely. And I think like before I worked in the school, I was a bit nitpicky with them about behavioural stuff. Whereas now, since being in the school, I'm like, you know what, guys, you guys are amazing.
Yeah.
I was like, forget what I said about you guys being too chatty and that. You know, I've seen the other end of the scale when kids won't listen, they won't be quiet. And if you get them to sit down for a few minutes, it's a great achievement. You know, but it's really cool because, you know, some of them have got really challenging backgrounds. Some of them have got things like ADHD and stuff like that. So actually it's about trying to manage them. And the only way you can do that really is by trying to build a relationship with them. And so, yeah, so I've had to use a lot of what I've learned over the years in coaching to try to build that relationship again with kids, but in a school setting, which has been quite cool. And obviously, and the reason I'm here today is because I've recently published a book called Introduction to the Constraints-Led Approach, looking at how the constraints-led approach can be applied in football or soccer, if you're American. And I suppose that's what we're going to discuss more about here.
Yeah, definitely. Interesting background. Thanks for sharing. And you mentioned your book, and you know that is going to dominate our conversation today. And I'm really looking forward to getting onto that. But I suppose just before we get into the book, just tell us a bit more about, you know, your master's. So you were talking about how you're looking at coaching behaviour, which is a really interesting topic, I think. Something that I'm actually looking to look at myself for my own research project within my master's. So just tell us a bit more about the master's. How's that going? Tell us a bit more about your project, if you can, depending on how far you're into it, I guess.
Yeah, so we're currently in the process of data collection, which is I'm conducting interviews and talking to coaches and trying to get their thoughts and feelings and opinions on how they behave and stuff like that. It's been tricky with the lockdown because through the process, you've had to change things. So I would have loved to have been able to observe coaches during sessions and then talk to them about what they've done and what they've observed and, you know, have them mic'd up and have a GoPro on them to record everything. I thought that would be brilliant. But then with the lockdown, we've had to change it to make it applicable. Otherwise, I didn't want to be waiting for this whole thing to end. And looking back, it was actually a really good decision because it meant I could continue with the data collection even during a lockdown, which is great. So my study is more looking around the idea of sociology. So I'm fascinated by like a sociologist known as Irving Goffman, and he had a particular theory known as impression management, which suggested that in social situations, we as people try to manage the impression we give off to everyone else in the situation, and we try to manage it to get the outcome that we want from the situation that we're in. And I thought that was really interesting and really applicable to coaching, because as a coach, you're playing the role of a coach, and so sometimes you have to behave in certain ways, you know, to get a certain outcome you're looking for, whether that be behavioural or from a learning perspective. And is trying to find out, actually looking at academy coaches, how do they behave? Does any of this sociological theory sort of transfer across? Is there any crossover there? Because when I was doing my BSc for undergraduate, my dissertation, I kept a diary for like an entire season of coaching, talking about how I interacted with athletes and how they behaved around me and all stuff like that. And that was the idea of looking into how much as a coach do you find actually in the session I did this, but then looking back on it, I was only doing it because I thought actually in this situation, this is what I had to do, even though it wasn't sort of what I've truly believed in or whatever. Or I found myself that I often end up putting on a sort of performance myself when I'm coaching. And that was actually really interesting because the group I was at the time were a very good group, but they had a few challenging kids in there. So it was quite interesting being sort of dropped into that environment, seeing, all right, how do the kids behave around me? And then, because I hadn't coached that much with them, it was about actually, like, well, I remember when I first arrived, and this was in under 12s, and four of them tried to rugby tackle me. I remember just standing there looking at the other coach like, what on earth's going on? You know, what do I do? Now I've got like, and I'm literally stood up there like a climbing frame with like kids on my arms. I'm trying to walk, like say, come on, what? You know, because you don't know what is the appropriate response in certain situations, you know. And it's a bit of a shame with the lockdown, because what I'd love to do one day is just looking at studies as how much is the coach putting it on, but how much is the athlete putting it on the other way, yeah. Which I think would be a really fascinating thing. But I think it would be incredible to look at, because I remember one instance which was hilarious looking back, but it was one of those ones where there was this one kid in the group who was very good at football, but was a challenging individual from a behavioural point of view. And I always felt that actually he always tried to push me wherever he could to try to impress people. And I remember one day in training, when I was waiting for it to begin, he's come over to me, and I remember him standing on like the bag of footballs, and it's only me and him, and he's looked me in the eye and he said, I think you're my favourite coach I've had. And I immediately thought, wow, that's amazing. You know, I've known the kid for a few months. He's got other coaches from other teams and stuff like that. This is awesome. And then as I'm getting worked up my head, thinking, oh, I must be doing a great job. Yeah, you know, doing brilliantly. He then goes to me, but you've got a stupid beard. And then he jumped off the bag of balls and ran and told his mates about my stupid beard, which wasn't stupid. It was actually very nice. But it was because he had to be, so to his mates, he had to come across as this individual who took the mick out of coaches and was always looking to be the joker. But to me, he was completely different. So he was actually, you just see a switch immediately. And I think actually, you could go, if you wanted to go really, really deep into it, you could, you know, unpick loads of stuff around honesty and trust and how much honesty is actually required. And is it just a matter of the coach is playing the role of a coach, the athlete is playing the role of an athlete. If you go back to Goffman's stuff on impression management and just behaving how you think best fits a situation, actually nothing really matters, because we're all just playing a role. We're all just trying to get through to the next situation, and it actually doesn't matter, you know, what's really going on. Mm. You know, it's like, because I remember some people talk about like the idea of like an iceberg, and how all the meaning is below the surface and all that. And I was thinking, well, I was like, but if I'm as a coach playing a role, and I was conscious that I am playing a role, and then there's athletes there who, they might not think of it as playing a role, but they're certainly very aware of how they're behaving in different situations. And then actually there's nothing below the surface, because we're both just thinking, right, how do we best get along in this situation? And that's it. In which case there's nothing below the surface. The only thing that does matter is what you can see. And that's it. So there's nothing, there's no deeper explanation. There's no deeper meaning to it. You know, so I think that would sort of be, that's something I would like to do in the future. But I mean, saying this is slightly ironic, because we're to talk about a book I've written on pedagogy. But yeah, so but instead we're talking about coaching behaviour, then sociology applies to it.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, you make some really interesting points there. And, you know, the concept of impression management is something that has always, you know, fascinated me as well. And a lot of work into it recently. And, you know, what I think what people don't forget is that it is very, being a coach is very similar to being an actor at times, is, you know, whether you're doing it consciously or subconsciously, you are putting on certain impressions, certain behaviors, acting in certain ways with your actions, you know, almost to conform to the expectations of the group that you're working with. And I've always found that really interesting, you know, not just in coaching, but in society in general. So I certainly share your interest there. And, you know, and I have to say, I do think that would be an interesting sort of to see how, you know, how your players impression manage. And like you say, I've had that as well, where you speak to a player on their own, they're absolutely fantastic. Then they try and put you in front of the other players or whatever. So it is really interesting. So, you know, to be fair, I think we could probably do a podcast episode on that, and maybe that will have to be a later date. But if we just move back onto your book, and I think just before we really get into this, this conversation today, do you just want to go into, you know, why did you decide to create this book? And, you know, I have to say, and I've been pulling it on my Twitter and Instagram, I think it's an absolutely fantastic read. It certainly something, you know, as I said to you, I could have done with probably in second or third year myself. But you know, tell us how the book came about. Tell us what inspired you to, you know, to create this book.
So essentially, when I was at undergraduate level, I studied the constraints-led approach. And my lecturer was brilliant and very, very passionate about the constraints-led approach. However, the reading around the subject I found very complex. And I felt actually there's a lot of big words, there's a lot of concepts that I can't quite get my head around, and I found it very tricky. So by the end of first year, I had a collection of essays I'd done on the constraints-led approach, either on like ecological dynamics or skill acquisition or perception action and stuff like that. And I thought, okay, I've done them, finished my undergraduate degree, then my new season of coaching, I want to use a constraints-led approach as much as I can, because I think that will improve performance better than what maybe we were doing previously. So I had a look online to try and find something explaining the constraints-led approach with a very clear sort of just a very clear example of how it can be applied practically. And what I found was lots of coaching books with practices in them, you know, with like Klopp's practices and Guardiola's practices and stuff like that. And then I found the other end of the spectrum of academic textbooks of 400 pages written by lots of academics, you know, and I thought, okay, well, I don't want to read the textbook because I feel I wouldn't be able to get into it. So I won't get by that. But then I don't like trying to pick up sessions from the elite setting and drop it in my grassroots setting and expect it to work, because when I've tried it in the past, it hasn't worked, and I haven't understood why it hasn't worked. And that has made me question things which are, now looking back, I shouldn't have really questioned, because it was just the environments were completely different and everything around the environment was completely different. So I thought, actually, no, what there needs to be is a book that has some theory, but not loads, just some, but with practical examples of how the theory can be applied, but all in one place. So then I thought, actually, well, I can plan some practices with a constraints-led approach. I've already got essays on it. So I sort of put them together into a massive document, then tweaked the essays around a bit so they made a bit more of a cohesive sense, adjusted some of the practicals, you know, and then I tried to look into publication. It got peer reviewed. They ripped it to shreds. They said it was rubbish and useless. And I was like, oh, God, this is terrible. So then I had to rejig quite a lot of it. But looking back, it probably does make a lot more sense now. Because what was clear to me after they reviewed it was I'd written it for my lecturers. So the way they wanted me to write it is how I'd written it. So for me, I thought this is how all academics want it. Whereas then the peer reviewers looked at it and like, no. And I was like, oh, okay. Now I see what you mean, because yeah, they pulled me up on things that I was doing. And I remember, oh yeah, well, I was only doing that because my lecturer who was marking it originally, that's what they liked.
Yeah.
So I had to change a few things just to make it a bit more sort of applicable then. But then the idea is that it's a book that has theory in it, but the theory is explained and it's not too heavy. The book is only like 120 pages, 130 pages. And to be honest, most of it is pictures. You know, it is academically informed, but most of it is pictures. So there's still theory to it, but I suppose most of the theory is me saying, here's what an academic said, and like paraphrasing what the literature says, and then me saying, and what I think this means is this, to try to explain it a little bit simpler. And then the second half of the book is, here's practices that you can use in football, which are laid out using the theory that has just been discussed, so you can see clearly how the theory you've just read about underpins these practices that you can do in your own setting, rather than having to pick up practices you see on Twitter or Instagram or in a sort of coaching practices book and then trying to drop it in your own setting. Because unless the settings are exactly the same and the players are exactly the same, it probably won't work anywhere near as well. And it's not that you've probably done everything right. It's just that the settings are so different and the players are different. So, or it could be as simple as one person who turns out to be key in the practice has had a really bad day in school or a bad day in work. They turn up to your practice in a bad mood. And when you're asking them to do whatever you need them to do for the practice, they're not having any of it. So they're in a bad way. And naturally, the whole thing falls apart. And you're like, well, hang on a sec. Why is this not working? So the aim of the book is just to try to give coaches a single resource where they can have theory explained to them with practices that they can then implement in their sessions all in one book. So it's a book you can read in your own time, but also take the book to your sessions to use the practices in the sessions you deliver.
Definitely. And just checking my mics on there. Yeah, and I think, Ben, I think you do that really well. You know, what I really like about the book is it is explained in layperson terms. And, you know, one of the big reasons for me setting up this podcast was I always feel that there is such a big gap between all this fantastic, topics and concepts and theory within, you know, the sports coaching academia world as such. And, you know, I think there's a big problem that transferring that into, you know, the actual practical sessions, I think there's a massive gap there. And you know, one of the reasons I set up the podcast. So I think you do that really well in the book. And, you know, to me, it's where I think we really need to go with the resources we're putting out there now, you know, to really help coaches that haven't spent 4 or 5 years doing an undergraduate and a master's degree, you know, spending all that time learning these concepts to actually go, that makes sense. And then here's an example of how you might do that. And I think you make a really good point as well, is that these theories don't always consider the context. So CLA, brilliant, but does it work in this context as opposed to this one? Not always necessarily. So I think you do that really, really well in the book as well. So, you know, I guess...
The Sports Coaching Podcast with Sam Holmshaw.
Today's topic basically follows your book, Ben. So, you know, we're going to talk about an introduction to the constraints-led approach and its application in football. So I think, you know, following on from what you've just been talking about, and I think a great place to start would be to provide an introduction to the constraints-led approach for the listeners. So, you know, for listeners that have never come across this, or they've come across it before, they've not really understood what it's about, do you want to give us a brief overview as such, right from the start?
Yeah, so essentially the constraints-led approach is a framework. And it's a framework which allows not just coaches, but it allows the learners to sort of be able to interact with what's in their environment, and for the coach, or what some academics refer to as like the learning facilitator, but in the book I refer to them as the coach, allows the coach to understand what's going on in the environment. And I think one of the things where I think people might get a little bit confused is that the constraints-led approach isn't a method, whereas something like TGFU, for example, is a method of coaching, where you can say, this is a TGFU session, this is what we're going to do, we're going to teach you game awareness and tactics using a modified game, and this is what it looks like, and then we can measure it in its effectiveness. Because a constraints-led approach is a framework, you can't really measure it. It just helps you understand what's going on in your practice environment and the performance environment. So essentially a constraint is something that alters the motion of parts within a system. And the system is just either you've got the system as an individual, where we are non-linear dynamical systems, and you've got the system as the environment, and how the learning facilitator can use constraints to create affordances within the environment. And the constraints-led approach suggests that learning occurs when constraints are imposed on the learner. So there's a quote from David who says that the aim of the constraints-led approach is to identify the nature of interacting constraints that influence skill acquisition in learners, which is essentially saying that what the whole point of the constraints-led approach is just to be able to identify why the learners are behaving in a certain way. It just allows you to understand what exactly that, why learners behave in a certain way, why certain behaviors emerge in certain contexts. And it says that the constraints can be applied, well, there are constraints everywhere, but they can be applied into three areas, which is the individual, or what's referred to as the organism. But that's as an individual, it's like the learners, and you've got the task, which is the activity, or whatever you're asking the learners to do, or what the learners think they need to do. And then you've got the environment, which would be things like the weather, the playing conditions, things like that. I'm sure lots of football coaches will be familiar with like training on 3G football pitches during the winter, where you train on a lovely, pristine 3G, and then you have a match on the weekend on a boggy, horrible pitch where the goals are like falling over. Oh, there's a massive puddle in the middle of the goals. The goalkeeper's covered in mud. And you're wondering why players can't control the ball properly. And you're thinking they do it well in training. And it's like, yeah, of course they do, because the environment's completely different. You know, and there's even, you can even go further into it with even training at night, training in the day. You know, if you're playing at night, it's different to playing in the daytime. So it's, that would be sort of under the environment per se. And there's a lot of theory around it underpinning it, mainly ecological dynamics. And what ecological dynamics suggests is basically, as learners or individuals, we self-organize, which means we can problem solve in the environment we're in. And it's interesting, I think you can be put off if you look at lots of theory around ecological dynamics, because it stems from like animals. You know, it sounds weird, but if you've got Netflix, there's a program on Netflix called My Octopus Teacher. It's a really bizarre program about a man who makes friends with an octopus, and he goes to see him every day, and it's really weird. But you get a really good case study of how octopuses, as an organism, have to self-organize in the environment they're in. So for instance, like the octopus will disguise itself by holding up shells all over its body to warn off predators. There's an amazing example where a little shark is trying to catch the octopus, and the octopus has almost no defense mechanism to a shark. You know, because an octopus is essentially a snail out of its shell, which has evolved to have legs and is now underwater. And a shark is a shark, so this is not really a fair fight. And in the end, while the shark's trying to get the octopus self-organizes and problem solves to stick itself on the back or the top of the shark, because that's the only place the shark can't get it. And then as the shark is frantically swimming, trying to find the octopus just sucks onto the shark's back, goes with him for a little bit, and then just releases off him. And it's a really good example of how the octopus as an organism has self-organized to solve the problem of a shark attacking it. And that's quite an extreme example when you think the book is about football. But it's still, that's an extreme way to explain actually, this is where the theory bit has come from. You know, with a lot of stuff from Gibson comes from looking at animals as organisms and how they interact with their environment. And they say, actually, maybe learners aren't too dissimilar. And a lot of that can cross over. You know, I suppose it's one of those things, it's when you sort of wonder why something isn't quite working. And it's often too easy just to sort of look at the players and go, well, you must try harder. You must try harder to do this right. And actually, it's because something in the environment or maybe the task that isn't quite correct. So that's not affording you what you want to see. And then you as a coach get worked up about it. So it's sort of trying to unpick that so you sort of understand why your learners are behaving in a certain way, why you're seeing certain things. You know, there's a really good discussion of it from Mark O'Sullivan, who's talked about it, who even questions the idea of telling the players what the topic of the session is and just setting up an activity, explaining how it works, and then letting the players get on with it, and then basically coaching whatever they do. Because if you can, he's sort of pointed actually by telling the performers, oh, today we're looking at shooting, for example. They all want to shoot loads. They all want to do different types of shots and things like that. Whereas actually the practice might not be designed properly for shooting. It might be designed better for crossing. So you might end up with loads and loads of crosses instead. And it's trying to get, it's essentially just a framework to understand sort of, in this context, understand behaviours of, in this context, was football players, you know, or learners.
Yeah, I think that's a really good introduction, actually. And I really like your example of the octopus when you were talking about ecological dynamics framework. You know, the example I always tend to give to people is, you know, my undergraduate dissertation, it was looking at the topic of threat perception, which is essentially that, you know, how we've developed over, you know, time from, you know, starting as single cell organisms is that when we, you know, perceive something that's a threat to us, so, you know, the common example is a spider, we see it bigger as it actually is or moving quicker to us than it actually is. And the whole idea there is that's the defense mechanism to give you more time to react to that stimulus. So, you know, I think that's a really good example there. And, you know, and I think as coaches and, you know, most coaches I speak to, most coaches understand what a constraint is. They might not know the word constraint, but they have an understanding of what it is. But the word that, you know, I know myself, it certainly took me a while to get my head around was the concept of affordances or an affordance. So could you go into a bit more detail about what is an affordance? You know, what does that mean?
So an affordance is an opportunity for action, and essentially anything in the environment is an affordance. So you could for instance, a chair is an affordance because it gives you the opportunity to sit down. You could stand on the chair, you could push the chair over. It invites you to do certain things in the same way, like in the school I'm currently working in, a table is an affordance because you can put your book on it, you can put your pen on it, you can stand on it, you can jump on it, you can jump off it. You can do almost like a parkour roll type thing when you run at the table and jump at it and then sort of roll over and land on the other side. So in a sense, anything is really an affordance because it provides you with the opportunity to perform some sort of action. So in a football context, it could be things like the width of the pitch. If you set up a really wide pitch, it will offer the performers the opportunity to get crosses in or at least pass the ball wide. And even that's just a really simple example of actually, if you want to afford crosses, you need enough width in your practice for them to cross it in. Because actually you want to invite the learners to cross the ball in because you want to invite them to perform the behaviours which you're looking to coach.
Yeah, you know, a good explanation there of it. And what I like in your book is how you explain how these are relative to each individual, which again, I think some people, you know, struggle to understand. So, you know, you talk about And I think it's probably important to say that this ecological dynamics framework is you very much perceive of what your ability is. So, you know, you see things based on your ability to act with them. So, you know, you talk about how a player who's very skillful at dribbling will often be afforded certain gaps to dribble in and out of players, for example, or, you know, a really tall striker will be afforded the opportunity to leap high and head the ball. So, you know, I think they're really, really great examples in your book. And, you know, I think the concept of affordance is something, you know, I don't know if you agree or disagree, but it is something really that's quite difficult to get your head around at first, would you say?
Yeah, for sure. Because the issue I think that makes it really challenging is with the constraints set approach, it's all interconnected. So everything is linked in with each other, which is challenging for someone who's just coming into the approach, just trying to read about it and learn a little bit about it. So essentially, you have a constraint, and then when you impose a constraint on the learner, the idea is then the learner is afforded different movement solutions because of the constraint you've imposed, creating the affordance. Where it gets difficult is you can actually over-constrain to the point where the affordance is still inviting the learners to do something, but what they're invited to do isn't necessarily relevant to the football. You know, there's a good example of like a two-touch constraint where players are only allowed two touches on the ball because the coach normally wants them to play a passing game, and they want them to play, you know, like Guardiola's Barcelona and stuff like that. And it makes sense because there's lots of times in the Premier League and in other leagues around Europe where teams do play often with very few touches. You know, the defender takes one touch from the goalkeeper and then they pass it straight away, which is fine. However, when you impose that in a group who are trying to learn the game, what you'll often find is you're affording them to do things that aren't actually relevant to the game. You know, if you've got lots of space in front of you, you should be able to take more than two touches. You shouldn't be limited to two touches, because actually in a game, you'd want to push forward into the space, not take one touch and then have to pass to someone. And in the same way, the defenders aren't afforded to defend properly, because they know as soon as the attacker takes a touch, their next touch has to be either a pass or a shot. So then all the defender has to do is try to cut off one of those two options. So the defender is afforded to do something, but what they're afforded to do isn't transferable to the game environment or the performance environment because of the constraints that have been imposed. So it's quite a fine balance to get a constraint which creates an affordance that invites the learners to produce movements that do transfer to the performance environment.
The Sports Coaching Podcast with Sam Holmshaw.
But no, you're absolutely right, and it is really, really interesting, and I am a massive fan of the non-linear, and it's probably because of my understanding of ecological dynamics. And you know, it comes in, you know, to a recent blog I've just wrote about, you know, why do we work, or why are we taught in this country, or why is that common perception to work from a technical model? And, you know, I guess when you have an understanding of ecological dynamics and what this is, and, you know, what people, I think, who work from these technical models don't tend to realise is that it does all go back to the individual, doesn't it? So, you know, what the individual is afforded allows them to create their solution. So, you know, it's great getting everyone to, you know, score like Messi, for example. But Messi's a short guy. You know, if you're trying to teach a young Peter Crouch, for example, how to shoot the ball like him, well, they afford two different ways to score, two different ways to shoot, you know, which goes back to their height, to their weight, to their, you know, body shapes and everything. And, you know, it's something that is, you know, at times quite a frustration for mine. But like I say, I think people like me and you spent 4 years understanding this ecological damage. We do tend to understand why. And I think, you know, this is probably a really good point to go into, you know, the constraints-led approach application in football. And you know, when I was reading your book, what I found really interesting was when you were talking about prescribed patterns of play. I know, and we spoke about this off air. And when I was reading it, it really did make me sit back and think, because I think about me as a coach now. You know, I've just gone into this women's team of 4 months. And I've very much taken this approach of non-linear, you know, not non-linear pedagogy is I guess the sort of coach I am, and allowing players to come up with their own solutions and try and encourage that. But, you know, when we think about patterns to play, well, you know, my playing philosophy as such is this Ike style of play, and I want us to play attacking forwards, always going forwards, always looking to rotate positions, you know, very possession-based. But what really took me back was, well, hang on a minute, Sam, that's quite prescribed. You know, and there's been times where players have almost lobbed the ball forwards for long ball, and I've been, well, I don't want you to do that. But again, I'm correcting myself about the solution they're creating. And you know, and you know, you write that very well in the book, and I found that really, really interesting, and it did make me reflect on my own practice. So, and I'm sorry, I know I've just gone on a bit there. So just, you know, firstly, tell us about an application of constraints-led approach in football, and then if you don't mind, just going on to prescribed patterns of play.
Yeah, so essentially, chances are coaches have already used a constraints-led approach in some way, in something that they've done. Because lots of the sessions that are in the book are not, hopefully not too dissimilar. There's lots of things like, just if you want to work on passing, things like 2v2 plus 2, just things like that that aren't too almost distant from what people are doing already. You know, hopefully it explains, you know, why this would work and maybe why something might not work. There's a little bit about rondos, and there's a bit of talk about how are they actually effective, or are they effective for learning and maybe not so much. But then again, it depends on what the intention of the session is. But if you understand those things, then you won't be able to use a rondo in a good way. You know, but I think people get wound up because they don't understand all the things going around them. In terms of prescribed patterns of play, it is an interesting one because there's a lot of stuff connected to it. So essentially, what I talk about in the book is very prescribed patterns of play, and essentially it's a rant over a few pages from me of why I don't like prescribed patterns of play. And it's not as academically informed as the rest of the book, but I wanted to get it in there anyway, because I think there's some theory behind it, hopefully you can see a connection between them. Because my issue with it is, if you think that learning is non-linear, and if you think that learners problem solve and find their own solutions to the problem by reacting to what's presented to them in the environment they're in, then you can't also expect prescribed patterns of play to be that effective from a learning perspective, that is. And this is where it's tricky. In a professional game, which again, where as coaches is very often too easy to take ideas from, I understand why they would do patterns of play. Because you've got loads of data, loads of information, loads of performance analysis. You can accurately predict how a team will line up, how they play and how they move, which means if you wanted to, you can prescribe your team to play from A to B to C because of what you think the opposition is going to do. Sometimes they don't even do it based on what the opposition is going to do. They just do it based on what they want to see. Now, I'm a Chelsea fan, and we've had a lot of Italian coaches like Sarri and Conte who religiously stick by prescribed patterns of play. What can be amazing is if you look at some brilliant goals where it's fast-flowing football, it almost, and you sort of think, oh, it almost looks like they've rehearsed this. That's probably because they have. It's probably because they've spent 3 months being drilled into doing that exact movement. And most of the time in games, it doesn't work because the opposition just go, well, I'll just intercept the pass when it goes from B to C. And this is the issue I have with it is I have no problem with coaches trying to say to their players, here's how we want to play. And if you want fullbacks to go forward, great, yeah. I have no issue with that. However, I do have an issue if coaches insist on, so take playing out from the back, if they insist on the centre-back splitting all the time and it going to one of the centre-backs, then to a full-back, then either into midfield or up the wing or whatever you want to do, but sort of prescribing it, saying it must go from A to B to C. Because my problem is then is you're sort of creating robots to just reproduce the same movement solution time and time and time again. And again, this goes back into the linear approach where previous research on sort of motor learning suggested that humans were like computers and we just think like computers and we can save information and then just bring it out when we need it. So if we worked on a pattern of play, if we do it, it eventually will become automatic. And for the podcast, I'm doing like air quotes because I'm trying to hint that it's not automatic at all. But they do it so it's supposed to be automatic so that players don't have to make decisions. And especially at most levels of football, I think you're much better off training players to just react to what's in front of them. So my issue with the prescribed patterns of players, when it's too prescribed to the extent where players are conditioned to thinking the ball must go from A to B to C, and this is where A and B and C must be for it to work, because they're not actually learning anything. They're not understanding, well, actually this worked because the opposition are doing this and we're doing something different. What I try to suggest is the idea of presenting it in the form of an idea rather than a prescribed pattern of play. So you can have an idea of your fullbacks going forward, and you could either coach it in a prescribed pattern of play where the ball goes from the fullback into the midfield, and then a winger comes narrow to receive the ball, and then a fullback makes an overlapping run, and then the winger then passes it to them, and there's your fullback going forward. And I know they do a lot of that in the professional game, and you see the same sort of patterns cropping up. But at most levels, I think you're far better off. You can present the idea, but then it's about creating a practice which is designed, which affords fullbacks to get forward, if that's what you want.
Yeah.
And affords the pattern that you want to see. And then if you present it as an idea and say, look, here's an idea of a solution here, and then it might be the player go, actually, we've got a different solution, and then we say, okay, let's do that. So rather than do it as a prescribed pattern, I think from a learning perspective, you're far better off presenting as an idea, which is like, here's an idea that could work. But based on the opposition, you can still make your own decisions, but because you're all aware of the idea, it can still work. You know, even if it doesn't look the same all the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it is really interesting, and it has really got me thinking. Even just then, you know, when just listening to you, and you know, it's like when you think about game models, which are obviously for football coaches, they're very trendy at the minute. I think game models are probably more in that information processing, you know, framework, if you like. It's often associated or suggesting in literature that, you know, people are either ecological dynamics or information processing, that idea that, you know, when you're in an environment, you perceive certain cues that lead you to making a certain action or certain decision. And like you say, repetition and memory comes into that. So, you know, it is really interesting sat here. And, you know, I'm sat here thinking, you know, about game models and, well, actually game models they are quite prescriptive. And it's funny because, you know, with mine, how I've always tried to go about is, you know, and you know, I like in the book when you talk about the four phases of the game, if you like. How I've always tried to go about is we give the sub phases, if you like, and a couple of solutions within that. But I've always said to my players, you know, whatever you think, the solution meets whatever you're trying to do for that decision to score or play, you go for it. And that's probably why it's worked well for our team. But it is interesting when, you know, I think, again, just quite recent, actually, some of the practice where I'm seeing stuff and thinking, well, actually, no, but that's not the game model. And then I am prescribing and becoming that prescriptive coach. So it's really fascinating. And I think you're dead right. I think, you know, I think about us at Leeds Beckett, we're always taught, you know, it has to be relevant to who you're working with, you know. So, and I always would say when I was younger, I always said I never understood coaches that actually had a playing philosophy like Guardiola, because surely that can only work with certain players. So, you know, I think that's a really great point of presenting it as an idea.
Yeah, so are you training players to produce the solution you're looking for, or are you training them to problem solve themselves? Yeah. And I think, especially at the elite level, there's a lot of control, and lots of managers are absolute control freaks. And but I understand it completely at the elite level, because their job depends on the results. And then if you want to control everything, then you're well within your rights to do so. However, especially at the lower you go down, and I'm a grassroots coach, so lots of the stuff I've done is from a grassroots level, where actually you've got a group of players, you might see them once or twice a week, and you've got a game, and you don't know what the opposition is going to throw at you. You don't know what problems they're going to create for you. So you're much better off trying to train players to be good problem solvers and give them the freedom to problem solve than you are spending your session saying, this is exactly how we're going to play. And actually it's about, well, you know, like for instance, with my group, we sort of have a game model, but it's a very loose game model. But that's because of some of the guys who I'm coaching, they're under 15 level, but they also play for an academy, but some of them don't. So it's about actually, or maybe we still need a game model for the academy boys, because that'll stimulate them. And they can then understand, actually, well, here's the four parts of the game. Here's what we're trying to do in each part of the game. However, it's still vague enough to afford decision making. So, for instance, when we look at an attacking play, in the game model, it says sort of things like, oh, go wide and get crosses in, you know, and use the width with fullbacks. And there's a little bit about, you know, if the winger goes inside, the fullback goes outside, but if the winger stays wide, the fullback goes inside. But we don't do any work on prescribing that. It's just those two players have to react to each other in the environment and do whatever they feel is the appropriate solution at the time. And we trust that we'll practice putting them in that situation to problem solve. You know, and then the alternative is actually, or if we can't do that, we attack narrow and we move around and interchange and rotate and stuff like that. But again, it's left that vague. And then we might do a practice one day where we do make it very narrow and we do try to encourage them to rotate and interchange. But the coaching is done when you sort of can say, oh, look, here's a situation where maybe you could rotate because, you know, our winger's being man-marked. So if you as a winger move into the centre, that might give us some space there. However, you try to get them to understand why they would do it rather than just say, oh, now when we get it, when the centre mid gets it, the winger comes inside and then you run around him and go wide. Because if the fullback doesn't do what you think he's going to do, all you've done is trained players to produce a movement solution which isn't the right solution at the time. So it's about trying to get the players to understand, here's a solution to a problem, and in training, we're just going to throw loads of problems at you and then coach what solutions you can produce.
The Sports Coaching Podcast with Sam Holmshaw.
Yeah, and I think that is absolutely fascinating, actually, because I can remember watching you know, the end of the Premier League season, the extended season, if you like. Man City playing Southampton, and, you know, I think they were 1-0 down quite early on. And their philosophy of playing couldn't solve the problem to score. They just couldn't do it. And if you were to analyse them a lot last year, I mean, what did they lose? Something like 9 or 10 games. 10 games where they couldn't solve the problem to score a goal. And, you know, I think about before all these philosophies were a thing, you know, in the real early days of football. Well, footballers, in theory, were kind of just all reactive footballers that, you know, go out there and win the game. And I always think about, you know, Gary Neville talking for Man United, and he said, well, you know, if we need to go long, we go long. Or if we needed to play possession, we do possession. Or if we need to do this, we do this. And if you think what he's saying there is, we basically problem solve to win the game. And, you know, it's really fascinating, isn't it, I would say. I'll move on to you because my dog's barking.
Well, that was interesting. I think this is where I think football is a bit behind other sports, where actually other sports performers are encouraged to problem solve, whereas footballers aren't really, because lots of the training is about just repeating movements all the time. So they get sort of drilled into them, you know. And I think it's sort of like my real bugbear is on Twitter, especially the idea of like, when people say, oh, this is Arteta ball, or, you know, Conte ball, or Sarri ball, or, you know, and it's like, no, it's not. It shouldn't be like this. It's far more complicated than that, because actually it is just about problem solving, and it is messy and it is chaotic. Well, that's because football is like that. It's one of the things that really gets me is when people say, oh, but football's really, really simple, you know, and it is, because they've seen a quote from Cruyff or whatever saying that football's a simple game, and it's like, no, and they've misinterpreted it, because even Cruyff said himself, it's just about problem solving. And he said his own Cruyff turn was, that was a solution to the problem the defender posed for him. And then what the coaches do? They take the Cruyff turn, they label it, they name it, and then they say to their, like, six-year-old, say, now, guys, we're going to do this thing on a Cruyff turn. So everyone get a football, run around, and then when I say do a Cruyff turn, do a Cruyff turn. And then in the game, they're all doing Cruyff turns, they're going nowhere, because they don't understand that actually the Cruyff turn was done as a solution to a problem. It wasn't a practiced, rehearsed movement. It was just, in that moment, he decided this is the right solution. And I think the same could sort of go across otherwise, when you think, actually, in football, you've got 22 players all thinking different things, all moving, all thinking different things as people are moving around, all getting different ideas of what they can do. It's incredibly complicated. And as soon as you think, oh, there's a player, oh, I'll go over there because there's space over there, then the ball will go somewhere else. And then you've got to think, all right, now I've got to think of that again. And there's so many decisions to be made all the time that actually I get why coaches at the elite level want to control everything, because there's so much out of their control.
Yeah.
And there's so much that if they wanted to, they could literally just say, go and play, and they'd have no control of it to an extent. But because they don't have any control of it, it's really risky for them. Whereas I think at sort of lower down, you sort of have, you can, I think it's a lot more fun to accept it is chaotic, it is messy, but that's because there's loads of people trying to make loads of decisions. And if they're still learning, which everyone is, they will get things wrong. So it's about accepting all of those things and saying, actually, maybe my team talk should be about, come on, lads, let's get the win today. Because there's so many things that have to go on and go in your favour. There's so many decisions that have to be made before you get the win that it's almost impossible to, you know, really get so hung up on it.
Yeah, and I think that's why, you know, like you said at the start, why your context is so important. You know, and you make some really great points there as well. You know, you think about in the professional game of football, you know, the job is to win, so you know, if that's winning by playing a lot, you know, long ball, playing it over the top, being really hard to play against. Well, you know, if that's what you're paying your players for, to win a game so you can stay in your division, well, like you say, you can completely understand why coaches do that with players. But like you say, if you're involved with, you know, youth development, anything really, you know, up to 21 and younger, then really the focus of your session is trying to create an all-rounded player, really, isn't it? So, you know, in that setting, really, the main focus, like you say, should be problem solving. So, yeah, I think some excellent points you make. And
the Sports Coaching Podcast with Sam Holmshaw.
You know, I'm just a bit conscious of time, so, you know, I guess if we move it on to our last segment for discussion, which we always finish we say implications for coaching practice. So, you know, I know we've gone over CLA, we've gone over the principles, we've gone over application in football. So, you know, for the coach listening to this podcast and they're thinking, well, how do I go about implementing this tomorrow? You know, what would be your, I don't know if tips is the right word, but you know, what would be your advice, or how did he go about implementing CLA into their practice?
Well, I would say embrace the chaos, because especially in football, there's loads of chaos. And I think it's really important that you get on board with it rather than trying to control it. You know, and even I realised the other day when I sort of heard about the lockdown and saw the way things were going, I thought, actually, you know, when we were playing the game, me and the other coach joined in. Because we were like, you know, it'll be a bit of a laugh, you know, with some of the boys, because, you know, getting a bit cold and we don't want to be standing around. And as having as we've got games coming up, you're not so focused on nitpicking or picking up on errors and things like that. We think, actually, if one of the lads does something well, even if I'm playing him, like, it's all over them and say, you know what, mate, that was amazing. What you did there, brilliant, you know, pat him on the back. But once you get into it, there's actually, there's loads of stuff going on. And actually, it is chaotic. So if you want to embrace it, even just from like understanding things are non-linear, it's sort of almost not panicking if things look really messy and someone is doing something that you think, oh, I've never seen them do that before. You know, I've never seen a real footballer kick the ball in that way or whatever. And say, actually, well, okay, that might be their solution to the problem. And then if that's their solution, then run with it. You know, don't try and coach them out with it. You know, just go with wherever the chaos takes you. And if it gets messy and if it gets chaotic, that's fine. Because especially if you're going on the side of a game, chances are players will be enjoying it anyway. You know, especially what I found is the sessions the players dislike the most are where I've got loads of control on it. And then they get bored and they're like, well, hang on a sec, you know, this is tedious, you know, we're stopping and he's trying to tell me this. You know, he keeps having a go at me, he keeps wanting me to do this and do this and do this, but I don't really want to do that. And actually, if you sort of just embrace the chaos around you and embrace what's going on, even though I remember when I was still at this barriers, from when you're trying to actually coach and improve performance, it's tricky knowing when to step in when it is chaotic. It's easy when it's like, oh, we're going to do a passing drill, it's out of pose and this and that. And all I'm going to shout at the players to demand the ball, even though that doesn't actually mean anything because the players don't need to demand the ball. And actually, you can see really clearly where an error might be. Mm. If someone's touch isn't great, if the pass isn't great and stuff like that. Whereas actually the tricky bit is getting used to when it's chaotic, when do you jump in?
Yeah.
And then trying to get the balance right for your own context between jumping in and intervening and stepping back and letting stuff happen.
Yeah.
And it's one of my little bit of a bugbear for me is if it comes to like coach education, where I give you blocks and I've just done like my B license and they sort of run through like 4-minute blocks. And I get it because that is largely underpinned with sort of physiological theory around intensity and workloads and things like that, which is fine. So for in some settings, yeah, maybe 4 minute blocks might be the way to go. So you can keep an eye on your watch and say, right, in, you know, 1 minute, I know I want to stop them to talk about something or intervene with some way. What am I looking for? Whereas in other settings, like in my grassroots settings, I tend to leave them for longer because sometimes it takes them longer to try and solve the problem. And I'm not as concerned with the physiological side of it because I know the lads who are really, really fit will keep running. Yeah. And I know the ones that aren't the fittest probably won't, or they won't run as much. So, but again, it's like trying to embrace the chaos and trying to work with the chaos. But my lecturer talks about it like almost like a carousel.
Yeah.
And a carousel going around in front of you and knowing when to jump onto it.
Yeah.
Which I quite like, but I'm annoyed that he's come up with it, which I don't like. But, so it's just sort of, yeah, I'd say embrace the chaos of it.
I think that's a really great saying, that embrace chaos. And it, like you say, it is really difficult because of how we were brought up in our own pathways and those perceptions that, you know, correcting things when you see it and it doesn't look like a traditional session as such. You know, as a coach, you can begin to panic. And I like that about not panicking. And, you know, it's difficult. You know, I've been there myself when you're in certain context and, you know, there's certain perceptions of what a session is. And, you know, not just from, you know, your boss or your parents, but also from the players as well. You know, I've particularly found that working with adults this year that they have perceptions of that. But, you know, I think when you are in, particularly when you're in a grassroots environment and it's kind of up to you and you're not being paid for it as such, I think, like you say, I think that's really great advice. And, you know, it all goes back to, doesn't it, of, you know, what's the aim of the session? You know, if that chaos is getting, you know, encouraging your players to, you know, become more competent passers of the ball and creating solutions, and it's providing them lots of opportunities to create solutions to pass the ball, then, you know, is there really anything wrong with that? And that's something I say to coaches all the time, particularly in, you know, a couple of roles I've had in coach education. And, you know, if you're seeing something that you haven't seen before, you know, whether that's a technique or whether that's a session or anything, we are, you know, almost programmed in a sense of how we've been, you know, brought up in our coach education to correct it. And actually sometimes it is better, like you say, embrace it, don't panic, you know, just calm down for a second and just, you know, sometimes let it play out. Yeah, I really like that, Ben. You know, I think just, you know, just before we finish, is anything else you'd just like to add, anything that we might have missed?
Oh, I suppose obviously the aim of the book essentially is that it is a resource. It's not designed to be a textbook. So if you buy it with the expectation of it being a textbook, you will be let down. So understand that it is a coaching resource aimed at coaches who are looking to improve their performance and improve the performance of the learners, and are also there trying to sort of just get them to learn a bit more and understand what they're learning. And I think one of the things that I found especially, I'm sure they're the same, is balancing the pedagogy side of it and just getting to know your athlete, because we both got big interest in like coach-athlete relations and things like that. So with my current lot, they love an unopposed shooting drill more than anything, and my book tells you do not do unopposed shooting drill because the problem isn't representative to the environment and there's not learning taking place and all the rest of it. And I understand that fully, but I also understand that I need my players to like me, because they're here out of their own fun and I'm here because I like them and stuff like that. So actually, even from my perspective, I don't always use a constraint-led approach. If my players want something a bit different, I've no issue with balancing that and saying, actually, okay, we'll do an unopposed shooting drill. You know, I've no issue with that because I know the players will like it. The thing that I will urge coaches, which I think you'll get from reading the theoretical side of the book, is understanding that not to expect the players to be good at shooting from it. So I'm not expecting everyone to hit everything in the top corner like they do when they do an NFL shooting drill. However, I'm expecting them to like me a bit more, because that's why I've done what I did. You know, because I understand the learning side of things, and I'm actually, because I'm on the side of non-linear pedagogy, and I understand what I learn is how people learn and how I think they learn, that can then make my expectations more realistic to what I think is going on. And then from a coach, I think, for me, it certainly calms me down because I know what to expect. And I think it helps then when you're talking to your players, because you have expectations which you feel are more underpinned than perhaps they were before. So if people are struggling to find solutions or they're doing things wrong, you know yourself, actually, well, we've been working on finding a solution to this problem. Then maybe you might be a bit harsher with your athlete. If you say, look, guys, in the sessions, we're doing similar things to this, and you know that they've learned how to do this sort of situation, how to problem solve, and then you can embrace that side of things. But that only comes when you understand the theoretical side of things. So I think it's one of those ones where, even if you just think, oh, I'm not sure about the constraints set approach, the practices in the book, they're not full sessions. It's not like, here's a 90-minute session using the others. They are individual practices.
Yeah.
Because I figured you'll be more likely just to drop in a session. So you might think, actually, we'll do a warm-up today using the constraints-led approach. And you might be looking at the dribbling. And then you drop that in there as your warm-up. And then you see what they sort of do in this practice. And, you know, I mentioned in the book that actually these practices are designed that I've used and I've had success with. However, in your environment, you might need to tweak certain things. Mm. And by all means, do it.
Mm.
But hopefully by reading the theory, you'll understand what you can tweak. And if you do tweak things and add different constraints in or remove a constraint, you understand how that then impacts what learning is occurring in your environment.
Yeah, and that's what I really like about the book, is that, you know, all these fantastic theories and concepts, not just CLA, just, you know, loads that are within the world of sports coaching, if we like, they don't always consider that. They don't always consider the psychology or getting athletes to buy into you or all that other stuff that does come in with, you know, particularly being a football coach and working with a group. So I think they are really great points you make. And I like that as well. How, like you say, I think we often think that we've read this book now, everything, we have to do everything on this book and it has to be done to that. And you're right, you're offering a resource for someone to take and to understand the concept more and impact that into their coaching. So yeah, I think some really great points to finish. So, you know, we've managed to be an hour and 28 minutes, which it's felt like no time at all, Ben. It's been a marvelous conversation. So, you know, I guess for the listeners, anyone who, you know, wants to just, you know, get in contact with you or follow you, see what you're doing and maybe understand a bit more about CLA, what's the best way to follow you or get in contact with you on social media?
So Instagram's quite good. So my Instagram is Ben_Bell_coaching. And that's where I'll share stuff to do with training practices, things like that. My email's also on there. There's also a link to the book on Amazon, on my Instagram, and my Twitter is @BenBell98. And again, that's the same. There's a link to the book in my bio, and I'm quite active on both. So if anyone wants to get in touch, talk about the book, has got anything that they want to discuss related to practice or coaching in general, or if they're perhaps a new coach looking to get involved and stuff like that and have questions, by all means, get in touch and I will try my best to get back to as best I can.
And I was just going to add, where can we get the book from? And, you know, I know you've said it's just on Twitter there, but I believe it's Amazon. Am I right in thinking?
Yeah, it's on Amazon as well. And it's also available from the publishers as well. But I suppose Amazon is the best place. If you just type in Introduction to the Constraints-Led Approach, it should come up there as well.
Perfect. And I know my brother's getting it for Christmas, so he'll certainly be happy with that, Ben. Listen, it just leaves me to say thank you so much for coming on there. a lovely Friday evening. Not many would want to sit and talk to me on a podcast, but I really appreciate your time, Ben. I think that was a really, really enjoyable episode for me personally. I think it really went over the concepts of CLA, went over concepts of ecological dynamics that, you know, can be really difficult to get your head around sometimes. So, yeah, I think that would be a really, really great episode today. So, yeah, once again, Ben, thank you so much for your time. Thanks, as always, to all our listeners. You know, again, if you've got any questions, please do feel free to get in touch. And we'll see everyone next week.